There's also a lot of little mundane mysteries that go on in the neighborhood, such as which of the cats has been leaving a foul smell by the back of the shop.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Keep It Fictional. I'm your host for today, Mark. I'm joined, as always, by my book friends, Virginia, Sadie, and Corrine. So today, we've decided to change things up a little bit. You may notice we're giving a lot of book recommendations to our book friends and other people, but we've decided to turn things around a little bit and take book recommendations from someone else that we know, whether it's family, friends, friends of friends, or some other distant acquaintance. We may get different book recommendations from different people for different reasons. So we're just going to take a crack at seeing how successful we are with taking book recommendations from our own book friends outside of work, but maybe also could be one of us as well. So let's start out today. I think we're going to do the existential question to change things up a little bit. The existential question is, are there any book reviewers, influencers, websites, acquaintances, or anything, anyone else that you frequently check for recommendations on books?
Mainly because I don't actually have a ton of websites or reviewers or anything like that that I use when I'm looking for book recommendations. I do have a friend that I used to work with when I worked at Kohl's Books, and she has always had very similar style to reading as I do. And so anytime that she recommends a book, I find that I will usually track it down, and I do usually enjoy it. But yeah, kind of that's sort of the main one. I've definitely taken recommendations, I think, from all of book friends on this podcast at various times, and have definitely enjoyed the books. Maybe not you, Mark, just because we haven't had as much of a chance to work together. But otherwise, I have taken recommendations from everyone else and have enjoyed the recommendations that were given. But yeah, generally, not really. I tend to look at read-alikes a lot. So if I like an author, if I like a book, I'll kind of look at what other books are similar to that if I'm looking for something new.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar. I don't really have one specific source I tend to consult a lot, but I do tend to look at different publishers sometimes, because I tend to feel like there's certain publishers that have like a certain kind of niche or focus, where they have like a specific label within a specific publisher that's like, okay, these are the ones that I tend to like the most. So I tend to watch some of those a lot more to see what's coming up, and then definitely will take those into consideration a lot. Or if there's like a similar author to an author that I already like, if people are saying like, oh, if you like this author, then you should try this author. Those are kind of the main ways that I will discover new things. Or if there's something new coming up, then I'll definitely take notice of it that way.
For me, I am a big fan of Book Riot's Liberty Hardy. Maybe not so much of the sort of science fiction or like horror, like genres that I already kind of know. But like when it comes to like, if I want to read something out of those genres, literary fiction, whatever, I find that whatever that she really, really likes, and she reads like 600 books a year, right? So like she reads a lot. But you can tell that when she's really, really excited about something, extra excited, those books usually matches what I like. So if it is a book that I'm like, I don't know about this. Like I find that when she enjoys it a lot, that tends to be something that I also tend to enjoy. So I take recommendations mostly from her for that. But I mean, just the whole Book Riot website is great. You know, there's lots and lots of different people talking about lots of great books on there. The other person I talk about before is Ron Charles from Washington Post, which I recently discovered, you know, is another person that I took a lot of, again, same thing. Like it's like books that I don't think I will like, but it always turns out well. At work, I'm going to let my book friends guess. There's like maybe one person that I trust, only because same thing as what everybody talked about is that their taste is similar to mine. So yeah.
Yeah, it's not me. Yeah, I kind of do. Virginia is my anti-recommendation person. Like, so if she really enjoyed a book, I'm like, okay, well, I'll throw that one in the bin. And so that's really helpful to know what I don't have to read. There's exactly like one book a year that we agree on, and only one book. So that's really helpful to kind of eliminate some books, not all the books. I take recommendations essentially from two people. One of them is Anton Herr over Twitter, who is a book translator and is coming out with his own book in 2024, I believe, who is a total delight and often recommends books in translation that kind of are smaller press or kind of fall under the radar. And so I find that he, because he's such a part of the translation community, I find that he picks really interesting books. And so I usually ended up picking those up. And then the other person that I trust above all in everything is RM from BTS. I even have my little RM reading pin that I wore today in honor of the episode. So any book that he reads or picks up, I jump on that interlibrary loan system very fast and read those. And I have enjoyed so many of them. Yeah, his taste is exquisite.
All righty. It's good to hear a lot of different sources. I'm sure we can check those out later on and see what we think of those sources as well. I will find at least one or two that we agree with, I think. Lot of diverse ideas there. So let's get right into it today. And we're going to start out with Corinne.
Yes. So with absolutely no surprise, my book recommendation comes kind of sideways from RM from BTS. Of course, he did not particularly recommend this book, but he read a book by this author, Familiar Things, which I talked about on our post-apocalyptic episode. And he is also the author of The Prisoner, which I read and really enjoyed. This is one of his, I'm going to say, quieter books. It's very melancholy. There's not a lot that happens in it, but it is a book that has stuck with me for a really long time. And so I feel like RM would enjoy it. His album Indigo is very like introspective, very like thoughtful. It's got a couple of bangers in it, but it's very good. And, you know, I know that the theme is technically recommended by friends and family, but all of ARMY is in a parasocial relationship with BTS. So I feel like it totally counts. So this is the book At Dusk by Hwang Suk-young, who is a South Korean author of some renown. And it has two points of view, both of which kind of eventually intersect in a really interesting way. And the author is asking the question, can you ever be forgiven for the mistakes in your life? Big question. But it also asks, are the mistakes that we make in our youth when we're young, when we don't really understand the world, as profound, or are they more forgivable than the mistakes that we make as an adult with full knowledge of the world? What really counts as a mistake? What counts as a betrayal? And who decides who gets forgiven? Do you forgive yourself, or do you need forgiveness from the person that you have wronged? One of our main characters is, you know, the middle-aged man, as you do in a lot of literature, who is looking back on his life and he has some regrets. So it is Park Min-woo, and he's not a terrible person. He's not bad. But his one major flaw is that he hesitates when he should act. And this has kind of haunted him his entire life. He is a successful architect who has kind of revamped the skyline. He's built high-rise buildings. He's incredibly successful due to his talent or, you know, the corruption that is involved with these ventures. Who knows? However, he is now alone. His wife and daughter have left for the United States, and they have let him know that they are not coming back. And as he starts to walk around his old town that he grew up in, he becomes disoriented. He doesn't recognize any of the buildings. He doesn't recognize any of the streets. He doesn't recognize anything. And that, in part, is because of him. He is one of the architects that raised that entire community to the ground and rebuilt it into something modern and new. As he kind of contemplates this change from the old to the new, he receives a letter from Cha Suna, who was a woman from this neighborhood that he was deeply, deeply in love with and betrayed. Again, when he should have acted, he hesitated. And because of his hesitation, because of his pause in deciding to do something moral, her life changed onto a path that she did not want it to be on. And she looks back with a lot of regret. In this letter, she tries to remind him of the people and the stories of that neighborhood that are now all lost and scattered to the wind. The neighborhood that they grew up in was violent and poor. It is described in the book as a slum. His childhood was not easy. Her childhood was not easy. But through his smarts and ability to put his ethics to the side, he was able to rise above it and become successful. But the price that he paid was by betraying his community and betraying the person that he loved. Our other protagonist is Jung Woo-hee, who is a 29-year-old young playwright who is struggling. She is trying to make her life in the arts, but there is no money to be found. And so she is working essentially 22 out of every 24 hours and living in a half basement. Where she works at the convenience store, she sees kind of the odd 3 o'clock in the morning people come and go out of the story and come and go out into their lives with their own stories. At the surface of it, these two characters have absolutely nothing in common, and you will be puzzled as to why we are talking about both of them. But as the story weaves in, Kwak Suk-young is telling a story about kind of the modern and the older city and how they intertwine and how one has had to be crushed or destroyed to make room for the new, but the new is not that great either. The violence of the past continues to have impacts on the present. And in this, I'm going to call deeply melancholy book, you see how that kind of rush for gentrification and rush for modernity impacts different people of different generations. Okay, I make it sound really sad because it is, but is it hopeful? Probably not. But it is like hauntingly beautiful. This is not really my genre. It's not really my thing. Usually I like, you know, more stuff to happen in books, you know, just a thing or two. But the way that he writes is so interesting. And this was the winner of the Emile Guimet Prize in 2018. And you can see why. Even though this is a book where very little happens, it has stuck with me ever since I read it last year. I find myself walking down streets and kind of doing the same thing that Park Min-woo does, of like thinking like, what was this before and what had to happen for it to be here right now? And in amongst all of the concrete and shiny glass, what was there before? And especially in a place like Canada, where we are living in a colonial state, who had to be set aside to make that happen? Yeah, At Dusk is a beautiful book that, even though RM did not technically recommend, I feel like he would really enjoy. To be paired, even though I'm the only person who listens to music while they read books, to be paired with his album, Indigo.
Alrighty, thank you, Corinne. I don't think we were particularly surprised by the RM connection there, but we can get recommendations from all kinds of different sources.
There is an entire Twitter thread called Namjoon's Library, which I will shout out right here, which chronicles every single book mentioned or that you see on his bookshelf. We're not alone.
Well, on that note, I think I will go next. So I'll be talking about The Nakano Thrift Shop by Hiromi Kawakami. This book was recommended to me by a friend who works at another library. They definitely said like, oh, you're definitely into these types of writers. You're into like the short kind of stories that kind of fit together. So I was like, okay, that sounds like something that I would enjoy. And I did. So Kawakami has been writing for quite a number of years now. She even began writing for science fiction magazines back in the 1980s, but it's only into the 2000s that her writing has started to become translated more into English. And we're still waiting on a number of her books that have yet to be translated. One other thing is that her books tend to have a sort of combination of like traditional kind of realistic narratives, but with also like kind of bizarre, out of the ordinary people or occurrences and things like that. So she kind of has like a unique skewed take on the combination of realism and like magical or bizarre things going on at the same time. And in this particular book, it follows the lives of the staff of the aforementioned Nakano thrift shop, owned by and managed by Haruo Nakano, located in an old shopping district built in the early post-war era. It's clear that this shop, they sell secondhand goods, not antiques. So don't get your hopes up too high when coming in and expecting anything fancy or collectible or anything like that. This is a place where you find discounted goods, household items that you don't want to shell out for a new one, but you can get like a decently priced one for that works reasonably well for the Nakano Thrift Shop. As I sort of mentioned before, each of the different chapters is kind of like a story or a vignette that takes place within the shop and the different employees there. But they also fit together into like a kind of larger passing of time, a larger narrative as we see these characters interact with each other, their relationships with each other, the kinds of like eccentricities and like interests that they have that will come up throughout the stories. So for example, one character who's Mr. Nakano's sister, Masayo, we hear in one chapter, she's starting to make these little celluloid dolls where she like builds the dolls herself. She knits little clothing to put on them and all these kinds of things. And then later on in another chapter, she's like traveling to a show to exhibit her dolls and do all these different things like involving them. So you kind of see this little progression aspect of it, even though each story could be read like as its own self-contained thing. You don't particularly need to read them in any order or like have to read all of them even, but they do definitely have like a kind of continuity and they kind of build up gradually. You get more and more out of it as you learn more and more about each character, more and more about like the different kinds of people who come to the shop. In this story, we particularly follow the perspective of Hitomi, who is our first person narrator. She's a cashier at the Nakano Thrift Shop and is often getting herself involved in the lives of her coworkers, as well as several of their customers through their recurring visits to the shop or through strange happenstance meetings or events that take place outside of work. Hitomi is a very inquisitive and like sharp observer of all the people and things that come through the Nakano Thrift Shop, including her fellow employees. So for example, she describes Mr. Nakano as having what she calls a middle-aged grin, as opposed to a younger boyish grin of someone who's markedly a man past 40, no longer looking quite so young when he grins, but has a sort of quote-unquote middle-aged feeling to him. So that's kind of like this little observational remarks that you get throughout the book. The other characters include Mr. Nakano, of course, who is mostly a reserved and private person, but throughout we learn of his eccentricities gradually. While he's not a particularly talkative person, like, but once he starts talking, it's like a, as Hitomi calls it, like a water spouting from a hose suddenly comes rushing forward and a torrent of words comes at you, whether you're prepared for it or not. Often this kind of sudden chattiness is what prompts the conversations of the staff to take a turn towards the main thrust of the chapter, be it some strange going on in the neighborhood or some new pickup that's coming into the shop from a customer. There's also the driver character Takeo, who's a driver who works for the pickups for the Nakano Thrift Shop, whether it's picking up lots of items from customers' homes to be sold at the shop. He also becomes romantically involved with Hitomi in a kind of, are we just friends with benefits? Are we in a serious relationship? Kind of like Twilight Zone in between, that kind of plays an important role in their interaction with each other, because it's like a awkward, like, which way are we going with things? Like, unclear part of their relationship, and definitely colors their interactions throughout the book as they sort of try to figure out what they mean to each other, what they're looking for in their relationship going forward. And that's another aspect of the book, is like the way that characters kind of relate to each other, the way that they manage their own like eccentricities of relating to each other. And we also see that in another relationship with Mr. Nakano's sister, Masayo, who's also in a relationship with another person who features in the story briefly at times. But these kinds of awkward relationships is definitely important to the story as well, because not only are the characters, I would say that the characters are very central to this book, as opposed to, like, as I kind of mentioned, the larger narrative that does gradually build. But if you're not invested in the characters, then it's not quite as much of a, probably not going to be something that you're going to enjoy quite as much. So I enjoyed the fact that the characters are developed in these gradual and subtle kinds of ways. So there's also, of course, the customers of this thrift shop that we see throughout the story. There's so many everyday and not so everyday customers at the shop, ranging from a potential Chinese mafioso who buys rare calligraphy scrolls, who Mr. Nakano refers to as the Yakuza Mister. The potential mafioso also insists on paying all in 10,000 yen bills, which he cleanly and methodically lines up in rows on the shop's back office kotatsu to mesmerizing effect on Mr. Nakano as he eyes the bills revealing themselves one by one, lined up on the table, flashing and revealing into a pristine and clean row of bills. There's a jilted lover looking to offload what he claims to be a cursed bowl that has brought his life nothing but chaos and misfortune ever since the woman who gifted it to him left him for good. There's a man with a quote-unquote vintage Texas lighter that has been appraised by a true Texan expert, he claims, as being valued at over 500,000 yen. But no, you can't meet this person. He's a friend of my cousin and he lives overseas. when questioned about he learned of the Knockno thrift shop, he replies through a friend of a friend that he was not from around the neighborhood, but an acquaintance of his friend's was an antique dealer who vouched for Mr. Knockno as online auction site. Mr. Knockno is quite skeptical of this person, and this kind of web of indirect contact he finds rather quite strange. So you see these kinds of different kinds of people who come into the shop as the staff try to suss out who they are and what their kind of angle is with these different people. And each of the stories is also named after a particular item that is for sale in the Knockno shop. These items usually feature prominently in the story or may only play a small role later on as a colorful addition or small twist to what has been happening in the story up to that point. But it's definitely a way of bringing in like the shop itself into the central narrative of what's going on in the story. There's also a lot of little mundane mysteries that go on in the neighborhood, such as which of the cats has been leaving a foul smell by the back of the shop by using it as a litter box rather than returning home, as that little mystery recurs throughout a few of the different stories, as they later find out that Takeo has been feeding several of them and has been attracting them to the shop. So you also see like this kind of aspect of the different areas of the neighborhood, the people of the neighborhood, the customers interacting with the staff, and as the staff sort of relate to these people, it's kind of like the central thrust or the kind of crux of the way that the narrative unfolds, more or less, is that through these different interactions that accumulate throughout the different stories. So sort of as Karine kind of implied in her story, not a ton happens, but it's kind of the same thing in this. A thing or two maybe happens, as Karine put it, but it's definitely much more a slow going, everyday pace kind of feeling to the story. So not a lot of quick jumps ahead or like leaps in action and things like that in this particular book. But if you like stories that take mundane situations that are infused with eccentric and colorful characters, or like shorter stories that form a larger interlocking narrative, or just enjoy like lively banter between a close-knit group of employees, then you may also like the Knockno Thrift Shop by Hiromi Kawakami. All righty. I think then we will move on to Virginia.
All right. Mark, this might be the most stressful episode ever for me. It's even more stressful than picking up your like top five picks of the year. Because as you probably all know, and I'm very much like Corinne, let's be honest here, I don't do well with recommendations. I know what I like. I like some very specific things. And I'm also the type of person that will give everybody say, oh, this is a great book, or this is a great show. You got to read it. You got to watch it. It's a must read. Then I avoid it like the plague. I actively avoid it. And I will refuse to read it until maybe like, I don't know, a few years when nobody cares about it, then I go read it. That's the kind of person I am. So this is super stressful. And it's also probably very stressful for my husband, whom I asked for a recommendation because he knows how picky I am. And as we all say here, we have strong opinions here. He's a big reader. He loves nonfiction. That's mostly what he reads, but he also grew up reading science fiction and fantasy. And that's kind of the two genres that he sticks to these days. And so far, every time when we do a buddy read, like we'll read the same book, give it something that I like, he doesn't care for it, and vice versa. So it has not worked out at all. And I would say probably the only offer that may have pass the test a couple more times is probably John Scalzi. But other than that, we don't agree on things. So the first series that he gave me for this episode, I try to read it. It's like a set of novellas. And then I read the first two. I'm like, can I have something else, please? Because it's not working. So he had to hunt down this other book that he was going to give me because he couldn't find it. But we found it in the house. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'm reading this. So it is The Snow Queen by Joan D. Vanger. And it is Hugo Award winner in 1981. It's also nominated for the Nebula Award. And there's three other books in the series. And unlike Corinne's and Mark books, many, many things happen in this book. Anyway, so if you're looking for a plot-driven book, this is it. So this is based on, as you can probably tell from the title, based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, which, because it's not part of my growing up experience, I don't know a lot about, so I have to go look that up. It's messed up. These stories are messed up. In our book, the Snow Queen, which is Iron Emerald, is the current ruler of the planet Tiamat. And Tiamat revolves around this black hole thing. For 150 years, the black hole is kind of like a portal that people can travel back and forth. So people from other planets mostly what they call the off-worlders. These are people mostly from this other galactic empire. They will come to Tiamat because there's something very, very special about the planet that they all want. But they will come here and they'll bring all the technology, bring their like new things, new gadgets to the planet. And during the time when the portal is open, Tiamat is ruled by the Winter People. And so for 150 years, they are in power, and they are the ones who are a little bit more tech inclined, and they live in big cities like Carbuncle, which is sort of the center, the capital city. And these people come in and they bring their gadgets in exchange for something that Tiamat has that nobody else has. But because of some weird space gravity, some reasons, which I can't explain, the gate closes every 150 years. And when the gate closed, then people can't come and go anymore. And so before the gate closes, all the off-worlders will leave. They will take all the technology with them. And with that, the reign of the Winter People will end and the reign of summer will start. When we first get into the story, this is sort of where just at the end of the reign, and the Summer People is going to take over. And the Summer People are the other group of the people that lives on the planet. And they are not so much interested in tech. They are more like they live in different fishing villages. And the Winter People, off-worlders, will call them superstitious. They're kind of more like spiritual, and they believe in the lady who is the mother of the sea. And because Tiamat is more of a kind of a water planet. So when the changeover comes, the Summer Queen will take power and they will sacrifice the Snow Queen, the Winter Queen, to the lady. That is sort of the ritual that they do. And this cycle happens every 150 years. And because the off-worlders will take the people who have come in to stay on the planet, will take everything with them, will take their technology with them, and the Summer People doesn't really care for that. When the portal opens again, then it's almost like as if everything has to start new again, because they have to relearn and regain all the technology, all the advances that they have made and they have learned about before, and everything sort of start over again. So knowing that, I mean, you can't really blame the Snow Queen when she was like, you know what? Nah, I kind of like staying alive. I don't really want to die. So I am going to do something to break this cycle. I don't want to give up my power. So I'm going to do what I can to make sure I can stay alive and not get sacrificed. So I don't blame her for that. So she's got some plans, some really awful plans that she has got going for a few decades now in order to make sure that she can get there. So this is sort of the bigger story that we follow and that is sort of at work behind the scenes here. But just like the fairy tale, the Snow Queen is also about two cousins, Moon and Sparks. They are Summer People, and these are two kids and now teenagers who grew up together, who fell in love, and they have pledged themselves to one another. And they believe that they are going to spend their whole life together forever and ever. And they also are convinced that they will become Sibyls. Sibyls are kind of like prophets. They believe that the lady, the mother of the sea, speak through them. They speak through these Sibyls, and the Sibyls can answer any questions that you have. There's so much knowledge. They know everything. And so if you ask them a question, then they can give you the true answers. And both Moon and Sparks think that they are going to become Sibyls together. On the day when they went to the place where they are supposed to get the calling from the lady, only Moon heard the lady's voice. Sparks, no matter what he did, he can hear nothing. There was nobody calling him. So only Moon was chosen. But that's okay, because they talk about this before, because they want to be together forever and ever. So they have already said to each other, they promise each other, give only one of them get chosen. The other one will say, no, no, thank you. we're just going to stay together. But when it actually happens, Moon realizes that it's a duty that she has. She has to fulfill this, and she can't help it. Like, it's not really up to her to say no to this. And so she decided that she's going to be a Sybil after all. And Sparks got really pissed off and jealous and mad because you have broken your promise, Moon. And so Sparks decided, forget it. I'm going to take off. I'm going to leave my home. I'm going to go to the winter city of Carbuncle. I'm going to go because deep down, he knows that there is a bit of him that is an off-worlder. Supposedly, his father is an off-worlder. His mother died during childbirth, but he has left him this medallion. And this medallion is very clear that it has technology in it. It belongs to the off-worlder. He's always been interested in technology. Even though he's a summer people, he always feel like, you know, there's some ties to it. So something that like his cousin Moon never quite understands. So he decided he's going to take off. He left in anger and he was unwilling to talk to Moon. He refuses to forgive her. And meanwhile, Moon goes off and learns to become a Sybil. Now, if you're familiar with the fairy tale, you know that Sparks is going to get involved with the Snow Queen. He caught the eye of the Snow Queen for reasons that you will discover, and he became her enforcer, became somebody that does all her dirty work, and he became her lover eventually. And just like the fairy tale, Moon has to go rescue him. So has to find her way to Carbuncle in order to rescue Sparks. And both of them get entangled in the Snow Queen's plan to stay in power for another 150 years in ways that is quite unexpected. Now let's get the bad things out of the way first. What bugs me to no end, and this has nothing to do with my like not liking romance, is this relationship between Moon and Sparks. I can't for the life of me understand why Moon is so desperate to reunite with Sparks. Like, everyone is telling her how all the horrible things that Sparks has done and how horrible a human being he has become and how he has taken on this other lover and is doing her bidding. And Moon is still like, oh no, but I can change him. I can do it. I don't get it. It's like super frustrating. And there's nothing redeeming about Sparks, and I can't stand him, which makes it really hard to read this book because I just don't care about the two of them. And that is the biggest issue with the book. However, I think what saves the book for me a little bit, and I something that I did quite enjoy, is the world building in this book. I really love the world that the author has set up, the setting, the setup of it. It almost feels like when you first start out, it feels very much like a fantasy. But then as time goes on, then you get more sci-fi, you get more space stuff in it, but it's still kind of feel like a fantasy and that type of world building. And I love the underlying secrets behind a lot of things that Moon as a Sybil can do, or behind the scenes, behind the power of the Empire and behind the Snow Queen. Like, you know, all those like secrets, I do quite like those. And I do think maybe I'll get to the second book. I would love to find out a little bit more maybe about that. Like that I'm curious about. And I think like many science fiction, it is a story of colonialism. It is a story about exploiting the indigenous groups, about nature. And there is definitely a lot of that where we have this empire who's coming in and like bringing in all this technology. And then, but we're not going to let you be self-sufficient. We're going to take it all back. And so in some ways, you can kind of see why the Snow Queen is doing what she's doing, even though her actions are absolutely inexcusable and very, very questionable. Like, I guess the question is, like, can you justify the means, you know, with the ends kind of idea? So the world is intriguing. And I think as the story goes on and it's revealed more and more about what's sort of actually happening, that keeps me going. So I do like that. And so many of the different characters, and thank goodness that some of the other characters are interesting. So, you know, you kind of like want to follow them. You want to see how they get embroiled in this like whole big plan of the Snow Queen and how everything tied together. Maybe sometimes a little more convenient, but at least it's still interesting. So I don't know. Am I going to read the second book? Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. But it's okay. Like, if you can, maybe you can get past the characters. It's just, I cannot stand them. I think that's my biggest hurdle to get me into the second book. So we'll see what happens. But it is definitely a classic, you know, in the science fiction. You know, it came out in the 1980s. So it's interesting read. So, you know, if that sounds interesting to you, I know I'm selling this so well. It is The Snow Queen by Joan D. Finger.
Thank you, Virginia. Definitely sounds like another interesting sci-fi universe. But also, once again, we have the do you read the second book debate cropping up once again. It seems to be a common theme lately around here. So we'll have to get an update from Virginia later if she reads the second book or not. So I think that brings us finally to Sadie. Sadie, what do you have for us today?
All right. So this book was recommended to me quite a few years ago, actually. It was recommended to me when I was getting my library degree. And when I was at school, I was a part of the student chapter of the Young Adult and Children's Services Group. And after our meetings, at the very end of our meetings every week or every month, however often we had them, we would always do a recommendation part of the meeting. And so they were usually YA books or children's books, as it was focused on YA and children's books, but sometimes they were not. And so this book was one that had been recommended during one of those sessions. And it mentioned London, it mentioned magic, and it mentioned mystery. Those are all three things that I am very, very drawn to. So it immediately went on to my to-be-read list. But at the time, I was reading a lot of essays and readings for school, so I didn't have time to do it then. And then time just kind of got away from me. So I finally, this episode gave me a reason to read it. So I will actually say that I'm thankful for this episode because it did give me a reason to read a book that was recommended to me years ago that has been on my to-be-read list for quite a while. And so this is Midnight Riot or The Rivers of London. It is, I believe, known as Midnight Riot in North America and Rivers of London in the UK. And this is by Ben Aronovich. And this book follows Peter Grant. And Peter Grant is a probationary constable with the London Metropolitan Police. And the night before that Peter is scheduled to be given his permanent department, his permanent division, he is tasked with guarding the crime scene of a pretty brutal murder. Now, this is not unfamiliar territory for Peter. As a police officer, he has seen death, he has seen murder, but this one is particularly gruesome. The victim had their head taken off entirely. So him and fellow constable, friend, and big crush, Leslie May, have been left at the crime scene to stand watch and guard it. Now, Leslie decides very late at night, they could use a cup of coffee. So she's going to go and grab some coffees. Now, while she's gone, Pete is approached by a man claiming to have witnessed the entire murder. He identifies himself as Nicholas Walpenny and continues to recount a very chilling scene where, after walking by the victim, a man turns back around wearing a different face, swings a very large bat, and knocks the victim's head clean off his shoulders. Now, Pete knows what to do in these situations. He knows to get the witness's name. He knows to get the witness's address and some contact information so he can follow up with him if they need a further statement. But when he asks Nicholas for that, he learns that Nicholas is in fact a ghost and therefore does not have any of this information to give to Peter. Now, Peter is not quite sure what to do with this information, but he does not want to give up on a perfectly good witness statement. And he's also hoping that maybe if he helps to solve this murder, he might save himself a life in the case progression department and a life of desk work and paperwork. So he decides that he's going to try and figure out how to get more information from Nicholas and if he can verify Nicholas's story a little bit. So he turns to Leslie, who is a little bit skeptical, but agrees that she will help him. So together they search through CCTV footage and find that Nicholas's account is pretty spot on as to what happens in the videos. But Pete is still a little bit unsure exactly how he's going to bring a ghost in for a witness. So he decides he's going to go back to the crime scene, see if he can maybe find Nicholas again, and get a little bit more information. He's at the crime scene. He does not see Nicholas, but he does run into a plainclothes inspector, Inspector Nightingale. Now, Nightingale doesn't seem too surprised to hear that Pete is looking for a ghost, but Pete needs to find this ghost. So he kind of brushes Nightingale off and keeps looking for Nicholas. He's not successful, unfortunately. And he goes into work the next day knowing that he probably has not done enough to secure his place in an interesting department. He knows that he's probably going to be bound for the case progression unit. He's going to make a valuable difference to the department so that all of the police officers who are doing real police work will not have to do their paperwork. Wonderful part that he's going to play, but a terrible, terrible life. However, turns out that running into Detective Nightingale may have actually been a good thing. Pete has now been assigned to Nightingale's division. And this division is a little bit different from the others. It is responsible for investigating the crimes that have a supernatural element to them. Through this assignment, Pete learns that magic, ghosts, and river gods and goddesses are all real. And that working with Nightingale does not only involve traditional police work, but it also involves the study of magic. And that Pete can, in fact, learn to become a wizard. So through this, Pete and Nightingale take on the beheading case. They find that it is not the only outrageously violent crime that has been taking place around London. You have a husband who kills his wife and his child right before his own face falls off. There's a mother who randomly and without question attacks a movie theater attendant. There's a bike courier who, again, without question, attacks a doctor. And all of these incidents seem to be a little connected to each other as well as connected to our original murder. And the events seem to be mounting in intensity quite a bit. Pete and Nightingale need to figure out what's going on. They need to figure out what type of supernatural being they are dealing with and how exactly they can stop it before all of London falls into violent chaos, hence the Midnight Riot. It's what they're trying to avoid. So Midnight Riot is a mixture between a police procedural and sort of an urban fantasy novel. I don't read a lot of police procedurals myself, so I am a bit less familiar with the style, so I'm not sure how authentic it is to that genre, but it does kind of meld the crime investigation with wizards and magic. I really enjoyed it. I listened to the audiobook for this one, and the actor who did the narration was kind of from the perspective of Pete, and so the actor who was Pete in my mind did a really good job, and I really kind of connected with him. He was really embodies the way that they describe Pete is he doesn't have a lot of ambition. He doesn't really act when he should act. And I think that the actor did a really good job of kind of encompassing that personality. It's a really fun book if you're looking for something with magic, but also like kind of that aspect of mystery to it. It goes quite far into magic. It kind of fully embraces magical systems and, as I said, river gods and kind of all of that world. So you do have to suspend your disbelief a little bit if you want to jump into this world. But it is fully, apart from that, grounded in reality, which I always like a book that takes place in our world, but that has magic as a part of it. So I would definitely recommend it. I found myself wanting to continue listening to it. This is the few times that I actually stayed in my car finishing the chapter because I didn't want to stop listening. So I very rarely do that, but this was one of the books that I did do that with. So that is Midnight Ride or The Rivers of London by Ben Aronovich.
Thank you, Sadie. Definitely sounds like an interesting multi-genre combination within one story. So definitely worth checking out, I think. So that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening again. We got a nice variety of different books that we got recommended to us, but also the different people who recommended to us, be it like a spouse, a colleague, or of course, the BTS Army Legion joining together as part of their group recommendation from RM. But we definitely got a good variety. So thank you for being here. And I also thank my book friends, once again, Corinne, Virginia, Sadie, and myself. Thank you. And we'll see you again soon.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.